I think when you hear my conversation with Jonathan this week, you'll hear that the two of us got along like a house on fire. And his stories, and there are three, are all so different and interesting, they will absolutely captivate you. Jonathan is a transpersonal psychologist, a spiritual director for men, as well as coaches and works with people to help them attain enlightenment. There will be a link to his website, simplyawake.com, in the episode show notes. In this episode, Jonathan shares some stories that might hurt your hearts. He does discuss abuse, as well as what it was like when he inadvertently discovered that he had joined a religious cult. So be sure to take care of your hearts for this episode. He also discusses something that took me back to the Matrix movies, and that is his experience of being taught how to bend a spoon. And it is quite fascinating, really, and calls into question just how much of an energetic effect we can have on our surroundings. And I watched a bit of a video of a seemingly normal person after a while turning the spoon into a whole bunch of curlicues, and I asked myself, how is that possible? Jim James said, "Some things cannot be explained. This is the part of the magic of life. There cannot be a word or an idea or a definition attached to everything." And then I found this other quotation that I absolutely love from Abhijit Nasgar from Lord is My Sheep, Gospel of Human. "When scientists are unable to explain a certain phenomena, it does not prove that the phenomena belongs in the paranormal domain. It means that we need more data and we need to carry out more analysis. If you ask a 5-year-old to define calculus and the kid has no idea what you're talking about, it does not mean that the calculus is something supernatural. It means that the kid's brain needs to grow further in order to comprehend calculus. The same goes for various unexplained phenomena of the world." And so I leave you with that, that perhaps it is simply that we haven't reached the point where we can dissect and understand that kind of phenomena, the spoon bending phenomena. And for me, that's delicious. I'd rather live in a world steeped in mystery versus one where everything is explained. So now, my interview with Jonathan Labman.
I'll tell you the story. One of the things that I saw sort of in my inner eye was this very white, bright temple, marble. A sea that I took to be the Aegean Sea because of the color of it and my limited knowledge of geography. And in the vision or the sort of inner eye, I had this sense that there were dolphins swimming from the sea into the temple and swimming all the way around the altar stone before moving out. And that was somewhere around 1997. In 2005 or six, I was in Hawaii on a retreat with one of my late teachers, David LaChapelle. Out of the clear blue sky, never having discussed this with him, never having spoken about it after the class, he said to me, "Remember that temple, that white temple?"
How do you self-describe?
It would actually depend on the context. If it were a spiritually oriented or retreat oriented sort of setting, I would say I'm a guy who's been on an enlightenment path for many, many years and have come as close as I'm aware to the end of it as possible. I'm also a very, very much an ordinary guy, right? I'm a baby boomer. I grew up in the 50s and 60s. I'm a twin brother. I'm a gay man who's out for the most part, sometimes on these podcasts, sometimes not, depending on the audience. I'm also a therapist for 24 years now. I eventually became a specialist in trauma treatment because of a confluence of events, what we would call synchronicity. and also a history of childhood sexual abuse and bullying. And, you know, I'm a guy that has sort of climbed out of an intense suffering to find a way to be at peace and content as this unique character or creature over here, whatever we are. It's very much a mystery to me by now. And so this is a very long answer to your question.
Actually, it's shorter than a lot of other people, so you're good.
Okay, well, I figured I better, I mean, you know, you're not going to condense 69 years into bite size, unfortunately.
I liked your answer. I thought it was succinct and to the point. And you brought up multiple interesting things that I want to kind of ask you about. Now, okay. You are my first twin. Just going to put that out there. Super exciting. And I have to admit that I am a little bit mystical when it comes to twins. And mm-hmm. I'm so curious, are you fraternal?
Fraternal, yeah. Okay. I have a sister who's 3 minutes older and who lives about 8 hours from me.
I was going to ask, does she play the old I'm older card when you were growing up?
No, she never played the I'm older card. She was, oddly enough for us, she was more assertive. And if I was being bullied, she would sometimes come to my rescue rather than vice versa. And she's lived in Northern Vermont since we were about 18 or 19 years old, lost her husband of 45 years, just a few years back. We have a close relationship and have had, except for a few years when I was in a religious cult. So there's another meme for you. It's been a long life. And, I'll tell you that there is, the way I feel a sort of mystical connection with my sister is that there are times when she'll be ill or extremely distressed, then I will suddenly feel ill or extremely distressed. And when I look at my own circumstances, as I've been trained to do, I see that there isn't anything arising in them, including I'm not believing any kooky thoughts of my own that would make me feel ill or distressed. So sometimes I'll just, get on the text or now that we use text and call her and say, hey, what's going on with you? I'm suddenly feeling like I have a cold, but I don't have one. She's like, yeah, I have a really miserable cold. So, yeah.
Well, thank you, because I was going to ask you about that. There's all this literature around how twins, can sense each other's feelings, or sometimes if they live one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, they shop at the same places, wear the same clothes, and they don't even know they're doing it. They're just making these choices in their lives that are exactly the same. And it's somewhat mysterious to the scientists. It's one of those things they want to figure out and they cannot figure it out.
Well, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is, the theory that if two particles ever collide in the universe, that they vibrate in sync with each other no matter where they are in the universe, which is a very poor layman's way of talking about advanced nuclear physics and quantum theory. But, I would say that there's some, when you spend 9 months in the womb with someone, there's a closeness. And what I would tell you is that when I go and see her, because she lives on a little farmette and she has chickens and a dog and she has her own business. She's actually a surveyor. So when I go and see her, within a little while, I feel as calm and safe and sleep as well as I ever do, even though I'm very happily partnered for almost 29 years now. So there's something about the proximity to one's twin, if there are not knives drawn anyway, which is not the case for us, but some twins have that problem. That just is intensely comforting. So that's a little part of that twin mythology as well, I think.
That's really beautiful. Thank you. And I have to commend you for very gently including the fact that you were in a religious cult, it kind of just, you know, if someone wasn't paying attention, it would have just gone right past them. But you, you know, you just kind of slid it in there. And I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'm always curious about the choices that people make. But also I'm curious about, I mean, this show is all about how do humans create meaning in their lives. And obviously right. people join organizations, churches, synagogues, temples, mm-hmm. because they are looking for that connection, that belonging, and that community. So I'm just curious. If you want to talk about it, if you're comfortable about it, what spoke to you about the, and did you, I'm suspecting that you did not know that it was a cult.
Correct. I was at a denominational Christian college down south. I started out in a Jewish family, and because of a very, what I would consider still a very sort of miraculous answer to prayer, as I was asking, is there a God? If so, please prove it by getting me into giving me a scholarship to international school at the south coast of Wales so I can get out of here. And when we were told that they weren't going to give me any money, I just prayed like crazy that the money would happen anyway, and it did. And so I became a convert to a belief in an actual God, but that was couched in evangelical fundamentalist Protestantism. Eventually, I found myself at a place called Covenant College, which is in Lookout Mountain, Georgia. Beautiful, beautiful location, similar to the location of high school, except mountains rather than seaside. And at Covenant College, I met people who were sort of creating this nascent community not far from here in Pennsylvania. And, you know, they were members of the denomination that the school was part of, which was in those days Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod. And I was going to college, and during the time I was in college, my mother and stepfather were divorcing, and they told me, basically, you don't have a home to come to anymore. You're on your own. And so I spent the first summer like that at college and working, and then that next school year, I met these people from this church community, and they seemed to really have a close connection, and they were very ardent, and I'd already lived for 3 months in a Christian commune in California. So I was looking for family, I was looking for love, I was looking for attention, I was looking for structure, I was looking for a closer relationship with the divine, because there was this, for some reason, after that answered prayer, and given all my early suffering, childhood sexual abuse and bullying, I was really like, there has to be a reason for all this, and there has to be a way to feel better. And so when you go someplace and you sit at a table with a woman who listens to your life story for 2 hours and exudes love, you don't have any idea that the other side of that is going to be that she's going to exude fear all over you and is going to run your life into the ground. And so, you know, the second summer that my parents were separated, divorced, my stepfather and mom, I spent living in the house of one of the elders of the community with one of the guys from college. And when I went back to college to finish, that family left the church, and there was a schism in the church, or schism, it depends where you live, how you say it, right? And that's when the church became much more sort of cult-like. And so, but, you know, I had pledged myself to God and to the discipline of the elders in life and doctrine. And the elders were really pledged to listening to their mother and wife, because two of the elders were, the remaining people that ended up elders were in one family. So basically then the reason to be there was a whole bunch of reasons. And I was so, I didn't have a family, and the origin of my trauma was in my family anyway, which I only discovered many years later. So you know, originally it seemed like great community. We had, you know, there were group homes for the guys to live in. You know, we would rent a house. The pastor bought a bunch of houses, and the members of the house, the members of the congregation lived together cooperatively, not communally. We didn't give all our money, but we gave pre-tax tithe of 10%. We were Sabbatarians. We were strictly celibate. It was useful for a number of reasons. And we lived in these homes with, you know, three or four or five other guys, made our meals together, had a sense of family. And we were very dedicated to God. You know, being Sabbatarian and trying to be celibate in your 20s is like, that's just crazy. So, you know, it started out looking really great, like everything I'd ever wanted, but just like my home life where love was there, but also this intense fear underneath of everything, there was always, you know, a control factor and fear, terrible, terrible fear and terror. And eventually, one of the ex-members of the church, we think, we don't really know who it was, tried to burn down the church. And when that happened, what the elders and this woman who was wife and mother did was to take everybody who was a member and suspend us from communion and blamed that fire on us. There must be some secret sin here in the congregation. And so you're all suspended from communion, and now we're going to go into an intensive counseling period for, this lasted a year or more. And if you don't confess whatever it is your secret sin is, you're going to be excommunicated. And if you go back into the rebuilt church that we're all, by the way, helping to rebuild, before you've repented, you're going to be doubly damned. And if you say anything against us, you've blasphemed the Holy Spirit, and you're going to go to hell, but the worst hell you can imagine. And by the way, you as a former Jew, you're twice as bad as Hitler if you don't repent. So there's the end of that story.
That is horrifying and yeah, also so hurtful. And I can't imagine you coming from the place and space that you came from, your family of origin, your experience there, and then your mother and stepfather saying, by the way, we're divorcing and this is, you know, you're on your own. So having that, that's trauma enough.
Right.
I completely understand why you were looking for community and family, but then to have this experience with this congregation, this collection of human beings that's so hurtful and damaging. And yeah. I mean, I don't even know, they must not have understood what they were doing to people.
I don't think they cared. I think they could see that people were extremely distressed, but they really didn't care. I do believe that the woman who ran the place had been traumatized herself. It was probably a borderline personality disorder. I mean, her husband and three of her children actually left the congregation some years later. I didn't find that out until last year when I read her obituary, thinking that I would find some kind of relief in that, but I didn't actually. It was long done for me by then. But you know, when you have all these needs, you've been traumatized. Unfortunately, as Freud pointed out, if it's unconscious trauma, there's a repetition compulsion. There's a compulsion to repeat, kind of reaggregate the circumstances. And then, you know, it's said in other ways that the universe has to teach you whatever lesson it is, and until you learn it, it's going to keep showing up. So I kept choosing those kinds of, well, I didn't ever live in that kind of community again, but I was a participant in other communities where the structure was a little too much like the leaders are it and you're not. And I'm quite, as you can probably tell by now, I'm quite opposed to that structure at this point. And I'm about to help another teacher who's assisting people who are leaving cults to give them some counsel one-on-one as a pro bono offering. So anyway, that's the cult story.
That's amazing. I mean, it's interesting. It was such a painful experience, but now you can use it to help other people. And I think that's really, that's beautiful. I mean, if I ever become a cult leader, it's going to be a cult of fun. And all we're going to do is have a good time. There will be someone in charge just to organize everything. But other than that, no one else has power. That's it. End of story. We're just going to have fun together. So I used to joke when I was in my old job, when I was in Portland before I went to seminary, I got to know so many people and they were all asking me, all these customers, so why are you going to seminary? The question, the endless, the eternal question. I had no idea why I was going, except that I felt like I was being called to go. Mm-hmm. And so I made up this thing where I said, I'm going to create this church called the Church of No Bullshit. And the tagline is going to be, we put the fun in fundamentalism. And it's just going to be about having fun. And that made people laugh and they liked it.
That's so great. I love that. That's wonderful. Yeah.
I think it's really important when you are the leader. I mean, of course, take something seriously, but I really firmly believe that if you're leading anything, one should not take oneself too seriously because everyone is replaceable. I don't care who you are. Someone else will come along that will be more brilliant, more inspired, more intelligent, more humble to replace you. I mean, and that's a good thing, right? This world needs more people that are better than everybody else. But the key word is humility around that everyone knows they're replaceable.
Well, right. I mean, and in the Eastern mystical traditions, we would say, really, there is no self. You know, what's here is the walking emptiness, everything and nothing, right? And so, is there a self to be praised? Well, yeah, in three-dimensional land, in traditional language, yes. And otherwise, no. And in what I would call absolute reality, no, there is not. So yeah, they better be humble because they're really not there.
I love that. I also wanted to just say I think it is so powerful and beautiful that your sister stood up for you when you were a kid.
Did. She did.
And I am, so people who listen to this show regularly know I get triggered by bullies. So I have sometimes said, and I'm talking about if I hear someone being bullied or if someone tells me a story where they say I was bullied, I get super triggered by that. I just get so enraged because I'm lazy. And I just think bullying takes so much effort and energy. And I don't know why these people are expending all that energy. But it's also really, to me, speaks to a very deep underlying sickness in our society that starts when we're children, And bullies who are children probably most likely grow into bullies who are adults. And
there's one other thing that I've learned. It's that bullies have typically been bullied. And it's part of the power structure to reverse the roles. And it's the same with child abusers, by the way. About 80% of them, as far as we understand it, were abused as children.
So here's a perfect example of how you're way more loving than I am. And where I just go to judging those bullies. And I just want to kind of rain hellfire down on everybody. So they'll be loving to each other and kind to each other and inclusive and invite everybody over to have fun in the party. Whereas you are coming from this place of wisdom and compassion. And you're like, hey, science has borne out, which I know this. Rationally, I know this, but for some reason, I just have this visceral reaction about bullies.
Well, I mean, it isn't as if I wouldn't have a visceral reaction. I mean, I don't like seeing that. It's more that was always my initial reaction was just punch. I wish I could just punch him in the face. But, as I later became a trauma treatment specialist in my life and studied with some really amazing guys like Dr. Bessel van der Kolk and Dr. Bruce Perry, you really start to look at everybody and the culture and the society differently because the people that are bullying others are often bullied at home. And that's where they're learning how to do what they do. Yeah. So, you know, the problem is it's so complicated. You know, when you're on the receiving end, of course, all you want to do is hurt them. But, you know, it's like, hey, wait a minute. You know, you people, unless they're really truly psychopathic and have no conscience and no adrenal response, it's like, yeah, I don't have that same response that I used to.
I don't know if I have an adrenal response, but I don't think I'm psychopathic. I think it's stress. I'm working on
Sure.
getting my adrenals back, though.
When I was very, very young, we were members of a conservative Jewish synagogue in the nearby city of Trenton, New Jersey, which is where I was born. We just moved across the Delaware River to the suburbs. But when my parents were separating and divorcing, we were taken to the Reformed synagogue, a Reformed temple down the street, which was a little more liberal. I guess there was less stigma in 1960 or 61 for being, you know, the child of a divorcee. And, you know, when I was very little, I remember candles being lit on the Sabbath and, you know, the holidays being celebrated and fasting on Yom Kippur. So there was ritual, but I don't remember any sense of spirituality. And even in the services, eventually in the Reformed temple, I was a singer and I sang in the choir and I was a soloist as well eventually. But, you know, I remember that was the only thing that moved me at all was the music. It seemed to me that the religion itself was sort of like as dry and dusty as a pile of ashes. And so when I found the when I was introduced to Christianity by a biology teacher at high school who ran a Bible study once a week at a friend's meeting house in our town. And then I was introduced to a congregation of people that I found some of whom were very warm and welcoming and loving. I thought, oh, right, their spirituality is showing in how they interact with each other. And so, but you know, the other thing is both of my parents remarried, and my mother married an Italian Presbyterian, if you can believe it. Okay, breaking the mold. And my father married a German English Episcopalian. So that was, you know, my introduction to religion was sort of all over the place. And then when I went abroad, when I won that scholarship abroad to the United World College of the Atlantic, which has now become a whole movement of schools all over the world, there were kids from 50 countries and there were every faith imaginable. But I was really, by then, I was leading Bible studies and, you know, I went visiting famous Christian figures of the day and even visited a group called the Children of God in London, which was an early Jesus cult. So I was introduced to all kinds of religion at that point. It was a very broad introduction.
So I have to tell you that I have a lot of Scottish and English in my lineage.
Ah.
So you had me at Wales.
Oh, yeah.
And I have to say that, I mean, I grew up in Illinois. I mean, after I lived overseas, we came back to Illinois. I ended up going to Champaign-Urbana for college. But if I would have even considered that there was a college in Wales, I mean, I did want to get out of Illinois. Let's be clear about that. But I have this real passion and deep sense that that part of the world is calling me for some reason, Scotland and Wales. So I'm just going to say super jealous right now that you went to school there. And by the way, Wales, I mean, I don't know exactly where the college is, but Wales is ridiculously beautiful. I
It
mean,
is,
I'm
yeah.
so jealous.
The college, I'll make you a little more jealous. The college was in St. Donat's Castle on the south seacoast of Wales. It had been a castle that had been owned by William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper guy, right? Who, you know, all kinds of Citizen Kane was made about him and all kinds of fame, you know. And it was on the Bristol Channel, which has the second highest tides in the world. So the tides would rise 36 feet in 6 hours. And we, because the school was founded in part by a former admiral, rear admiral in the British Navy, they created a lifeboat with a solid hull and pontoon inflatables around it that's now used all over the world by rescue services. And we were all participating in some form of community service every afternoon between 2 and 4, a couple afternoons a week. So just, you know, it was a beautiful experience. And it was actually the last 2 years of high school, even though they call it college there.
That's so interesting. And again, you made me more jealous with the castle thing.
Oh, the castle was amazing.
Did you live in the castle?
We went to school in the castle and in some other buildings. The library was in the castle, and in our second year, we got study units in under the eaves of the castle, but we lived in buildings that were outside of the portcullis gate of the castle.
Let me ask you, In this environment, did you just believe more readily in magic and wizards and fairies? And I mean, I don't know. I'm just such a romantic and I love science fiction and fantasy. And so I'm talking to you. I'm thinking Harry Potter. I'm thinking wizards. I'm thinking magic. I'm thinking just rainy days with like fog and rain and, you know, wearing a big, what do they call sweaters over there? Jumper. Wearing a giant jumper and just walking around in my jumper and being all cozy.
It's a very complicated question. As it turns out, the Merlin of the time, I think, did live in that environment. And in the Roman period, there was an international school of some kind of priesthood just a few miles from the castle in a town that's now called Plantwood Major. But, you know, I really only knew enough to believe my faith was very simple then. There must have been a God if I got a scholarship that I wasn't supposed to get, right? And so the rest of it was, I mean, it was just miraculous to me that I was even there. I was ecstatic to, and you know, to have gotten away from trauma at home and bullying at school and to be in this place and to be able to travel. But, you know, other kinds of magic didn't really come into my life until much later. I mean, the evangelicals are not real big on magic.
Not really. And I do, as a sidebar, I do believe, you know, in the lore and the legends of Merlin, I do believe Merlin was originally Welsh or from Wales.
I believe that's true.
He has a complicated name with a lot of consonants that's very hard to pronounce.
Like the town Llanillidvardd yn Gogogoch.
Yeah, I don't know what you just said.
Yeah, it's actually the name of a town in Wales that we all learned. And I probably butchered it, but, you know, it's one of the things that I remember because the language is very guttural, sort of like German that way.
Yeah. I remember... I read this series written by Susan Cooper. It starts with Oversea Under Stone, and it takes place, some of it takes place in Wales, and she uses place names. And I remember being a kid and reading it, and I'm like, I don't even know what I'm reading. What? But at the back of the book, she had a whole glossary of how to pronounce these strange, and I thought, thank goodness. So then I practiced saying the names so that when I read the book, they just came out normally. But Welsh is not a language to mess around with at all.
No. And unfortunately, we didn't have to learn it. We did have to take a second language. But I started with Russian and chose French because Russian was just way above my head in those days.
Have you ever witnessed or experienced something that you consider to be magical or miraculous in your life? And how did it change your life?
Well, I think the one thing was the miracle that I just spoke to you about, where we were definitely told in April of 1971, you didn't get a scholarship, you're not qualified. And there was a postal strike in Britain. And then it took a whole month to get a letter to me saying, no, we've actually awarded you this scholarship that you weren't supposed to get. And in that time, I was praying like a mad thing, and, you know, very arrogant of me to say, to demand that God prove that it exists, right? I won't say he, she, because the God of the universe and the multiverse didn't just create male and female, I'm sure, as we understand it. But at any rate, that was one thing. I mean, the other thing, let's see if I have this in the drawer. What did I do? I sat in a class with a guy named Eugene Ong, who taught people how to bend spoons like this, not just with the mind, with the hands. But if you went to try to do this with your hand, you would break the spoon. You would just snap the thing. So I also studied energy healing. You okay?
Well, I just wish, I'm going to have to take a screenshot of that spoon, because that it's like the spoon is curved around itself. Yeah. And that's actually really fascinating, because there are some really interesting, I do believe, videos on YouTube about people who can bend spoons.
Right. But generally there was some kind of trick to it. Now, I sat in a room full of 50 other people. We were all given these spoons that they bought at the dollar store or something. And this guy taught us to merge our energy with a spoon and to warm the spoon up with our energy. And then at a certain point, when we felt it was right and the spoon was ready, to bend it. Now, all of that sounds to some people absolutely crazy, right? But, you know, that was after a period of time where I spent 3 years once a month for a Saturday learning to do energy healing. And during that period of time, we even did past life regressions. And if there was one thing that I also consider, and this has just come to mind now talking to you, sort of like a miraculous kind of confirmation, I'll tell you the story. One of the things that I saw sort of in my inner eye was this very white, bright temple marble, a sea that I took to be the Aegean Sea because of the color of it and my limited knowledge of geography. And in the vision, or the sort of inner eye, I had this sense that there were dolphins swimming from the sea into the temple and swimming all the way around the altar stone before moving out. And that was somewhere around 1997. In 2005 or six, I was in Hawaii on a retreat with one of my late teachers, David LaChapelle. Out of the clear blue sky, never having discussed this with him, never having spoken about it after the class, he said to me, remember that temple, that white temple? He said, go and look up the temple of Apollo at Delos and spend some time practicing writing Greek with your right hand. I'm left-handed. And go and look at a statue of the Apollo Belvedere. The Apollo Belvedere looks like your partner, your husband. Right. So I go that afternoon and I look up the temple of Apollo at Delos. The dolphin was sacred to Apollo. And the dolphins are carved on the altar stone all the way around the altar stone in the temple at Delos. So whenever I have doubts, because life can still be very difficult at times, and going through the memory of my trauma when I was 52, fortunately happened after this incident in Hawaii, I would kind of hold on to that as like, well, look, I know that I've lived before. It was verified for me intellectually in a way that just can't be explained in any way that we know by normal scientific, rational, materialistic, whatever. So I don't have a lot of those really big things. And yet I also know that, you know, if I'm leading a meditation group and I focus energy in a certain way, the people in the room feel it. And they'll tell me, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, they'll tell me, gee, suddenly I felt really heavy. I was like, yeah, I was dropping my energy into the ground. Suddenly I felt a lot of light. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, I didn't say this to them, but I was opening up to the heavens, right, in the meditation. And of course, there's, you know, the divine energy is everywhere. But those are three things that really stand out that are, you know, pretty much mind-bogglers.
I just wanted to clarify, when you were talking about this vision and the Aegean Sea and this temple, that was in a past life, I think.
Yes, that was a past life. And, you know, that probably would have been the temple at Apollo, temple of Apollo at Delos would have been active somewhere around 1000 BC. And I was for sure in the vision, I was for sure a priest in the temple, you know, somehow involved with people coming to the temple.
I'll tell you something interesting, because I like you, Jonathan. I'm just feeling a really sweet vibe here. And I wish that we lived closer, because I would be at your house, you know, inventing excuses to just talk to you. And like, can I get half a stick of butter, or, you know, one egg or something? Yeah. But so years and years ago, you know, I went to go see this woman in Portland. I mean, 25 years ago, I don't even know how long ago. And she was well known in Portland as a seer, a medium. Mm-hmm. And near the beginning of what she was doing, she said, why don't we start? I'm going to start by calling in like your spirit animals and some guides. And so she did what she was doing for a while. And then after a few minutes, she like said, oh, and she started laughing delightedly. And she said, oh my goodness, you know, usually only one shows up. There's a whole pod of dolphins around you right now. And they are just so excited that you've come to see me. And they're just swimming around you. And they want to know that, you know, I mean, not that I'm part dolphin, but that I belong sort of to that dolphin family. Mm-hmm. In some way. And I thought, you know, there are worse animals, I guess, to belong to. Although I do love all insects and animals, because I think they all have lessons and teachings to share to us. You know, I don't kill spiders. I, you know, don't kill flies. I try not to kill anything.
I make an exception for mosquitoes.
Yeah. Well, those things are, yeah, they're insidious. So, Much later, I had a really, really profound dream where I was on another planet, and it was so visceral. It felt like I was actually there. And not only that, but the planet felt like home. It felt like I was at home. My heart was just so expansive, and I felt so good. But then I was in the water, and I was swimming, and I kept drifting out into the ocean. No matter what I did, I couldn't get back to shore. And I started panicking a little bit inside. And then this dolphin came up and let me grab onto it, and it pulled me back to shore and saved me and made me feel safe again. And I thought, you know, that experience is so singular and beautiful. And I viscerally felt that I was in another place. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, well, I think this is the planet of the dolphins. And, you know, the little trickster inside me is like, this is where all the dolphins from Douglas Adams books went after they escaped the planet because of what a mess we've made. This is the dolphin planet. And I found it somehow. I don't know how, but you know, it makes me happy to think that there are these really enchanting energies or spirits out in the world. Maybe creatures from other planets who can visit us in our dreams, or become important parts of our mythos, our folk tales, and they're still teaching things. You know, it's so powerful that you were in this temple and then there are dolphins, you know, because it's not an automatic thing to look at a temple, see the sea, and then just think of dolphins. I mean, that's what's remarkable about your story.
Yeah, it's very, you know, and I would not have thought anything of it, because there were other past lives that were sort of appearing during that past life regression. And, you know, I haven't spent a lot of time on this since then, but because my late teacher said that, and I was able to sort of intellectually, scientifically, materialistically validate it, there's a part of my, you know, my modern left brain, scientifically trained brain that is very happy with that. And it's been very, because I've run into so many people who've said so many things that turned out not to be true, and cult leaders and such, it's so important to me to have verifiable truths that can't be stomped on, you know, or you know, you can't really have somebody that's manipulating you with this thing, because you can verify and validate it. And that's really why I ended up in the traditions of the East, because you have your experience of unity, if you will, or transcendence, and time and space really aren't in the present moment. And that isn't anything that's, you know, been given to you in words by somebody else. You have the experience on your own. Now, it's obviously put into a context for you in terms of these spiritual traditions, but it isn't something that you have to memorize and then believe because somebody else told you. And I find in terms of our modern spirituality that I really look for, is there experiential evidence that isn't just suggested, right, by somebody else, or by thinking that I have to say these words to belong to this group of people? Can I actually have an experience of the ineffable? And yes, we can all the time. I mean, this is really the goal of the Enlightenment process in all the traditions. And I've seen Enlightenment traditions in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and in Buddhism and Hinduism, obviously. And, you know, that's where I find that when you can have experiences, when you can have an experience on a regular basis, you walk around living in that experience. That to me is sort of like, well, you can't really take that away from me when you take the words away. Or when you take the dogma or the doctrine or the community away, that's still going to be there.
What I think is really beautiful with the way that you engage with the world is, you know, I've read science magazines since I was a teen. I know, listeners, you're annoyed of hearing that fact, but that's the fact. And then also, I live in this really mystical place because of a lot of experiences that I've had. Mm-hmm. And it's really exciting for me. And I think you might feel the same way, because I hear the way you move in the world is somewhat similar. You believe in science because you were talking about spooky action at a distance at the beginning when we were talking about twins. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you have this deep mystical side. And so it's kind of exciting to be able to pull from both of those disciplines.
Yeah.
You know, because maybe between the two, we can create a really gorgeous whole for interpreting reality. One would hope.
And, you know, one would hope we're moving in that direction as a species, and one can easily get distracted by how much terrible stuff goes on in the world, to use polite language. And when I meet somebody like you, and it's fairly rare that I meet somebody and I'm this engaged with them, by the way. So I seriously would hope to stay in touch after the podcast is over, because this is very rare. But, and I'm not saying that to blow smoke either, to look cool, but, you know, I just feel that sort of connection with you. We have to do what we can, and it's not generally very grand. It looks very small. When I'm trying to run a retreat for my community, you know, I have a satsang that meets once a month. I offer a retreat. The satsang is free. I try to charge for the retreat. Nobody wants to come. I'm like, maybe I should just offer it for free, right? What can I do as one 169-year-old guy, you know, to make any difference in the world that looks like it's run by psychopaths at the highest political and cultural levels and business levels? What can we do as small people with no alleged external power? But we can talk to each other. We can offer our experience to others. We can offer healing to others. And, you know, we can break the cycle of violence if there's been one in our families. We don't have to pass it on. If that's a lot of work, it's very hard. We can break the pain, and that's hard too, but it's not impossible. You know, if somebody can recover from that level of sexual abuse, you know, when it came to mind because somebody in the next generation had experienced it from the same person who assaulted two in my generation, me and another. And, you know, I was left to pick up the pieces of a shattered view of my whole life and, you know, would come home from work and lay on the yoga blankets and either cry or shout or both, off and on for 18 months. When healing is possible, even with that kind of process going on, then you really maybe can hope that the world will change. But, you know, if I were to read the newspapers of any ilk, you know, whether it's Fox News or CNN or, you know, the New York Times, or the Wall Street Journal or ZeroHedge.com, which has some of the darkest news you want to find, you know, I would think that the world is a hopeless place. But, you know, when you bring this kind of recollection from me and we have these conversations and I hear about your experiences with the dolphins, I think, well, okay, people might think that we're kooky, but there's actually change and healing and hope here. And, you know, you don't see that in the newspapers. It doesn't sell product. Fear sells product. So, I hope that your listeners can understand that there's so much more than what is presented to us on the surface. And that there is, that, you know, I am Atman Brahman, this individual consciousness is the transcendent itself. And so is theirs.
We need to find a way to sell hope.
I think we sell it for free. We just give it away hope. It could make your life really miserable in some ways, hoping for something that never happens. But the hope that change is possible, that healing is possible, is based on facts. It's based on stuff that really happens. But the spoon bending really happened. The recollection of a past life by some teacher that knew nothing about it really happened. The award of a scholarship to a desperate 15-year-old really happened. Well, I was 16 by the time I got it. You know, those things. And the experience of being able to sit in the vast field of the divine in meditation at any time, that's an everyday miracle that happens every day. So I think that's hope. That's real hope.
Yeah. Do you think, last question, do you feel in your heart that you're an optimist?
I would have to say, because I'm content now and at peace, that I'm more optimistic than I was. But I'm also very much a realist, and I do see the ugliness of the world. I just got off the line just before we met with a woman I've just met for the first time who's been through endless trauma from her own life and then her children's lives. Endless trauma, you know, addiction and brutality and cruelty and the medical problems, you know. So because I have this very odd role that we call therapist in this culture, it's like I see both sides, and so I kind of have to stay sort of in the middle.
That's totally fair. I endlessly feel like I'm Sisyphus crawling up the side of the mountain, trying to be hopeful and optimistic. And then, you know, the rock rolls over me, crushes me. I have to run back down to the bottom of the mountain, start pushing it back up. It's a labor of love some days, a labor of stubbornness, a labor of desperation. But on my good days, I feel like I'm not going to give up.
Let me revise the image for you just a little bit. The rock never actually falls all the way down to where it was. The mountain just grows a little higher.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the podcast, and thanks so much to Jonathan for agreeing to be a guest. I'm grateful for his storytelling, his vulnerability, and his amazing ability to bend spoons. The little bit of beauty this week will be a link to a video about bending spoons, so be sure to check it out. As well, there will be a link to Jonathan's website in the episode's show notes. Please remember to rate and review. Everyone who hasn't, you know who you are. Those ratings and reviews are so very important and help other people find the podcast. And I have some exciting news. The YouTube channel is coming along, and I'll be announcing it more formally a bit later on. I'm still trying to envision what it looks like, so stay tuned. And apropos of some of the conversations from this episode, a quotation from The Matrix. Spoon Boy, do not try and bend the spoon. That's impossible. Instead, only try to realize the truth. Neo, what truth? Spoon Boy, there is no spoon. Neo, there is no spoon? Spoon Boy, then you'll see that it is not the spoon that bends, it is only yourself. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Jonathan. Believe you can bend the spoon. Believe that you are co-creating this universe, this world, this reality, and that in the end, it is really you. You are creating the dream in which you live.